Hello and welcome to another Thursday night of Blue Cirrus Telehealth Radio. I'm Michelle Hager, managing partner of Blue Cirrus Consulting in South Carolina. And tonight I'm excited to have a new guest, a new addition to the Blue Cirrus family, Danny Elfenbein. He has joined us as a business development executive, but is formerly part of the business operations for telehealth at Baptist Health South Florida in Miami. So we're excited to talk to you and thanks for joining the show, Danny.
Michelle, fun to be here. Looking forward to sharing thoughts and all things digital health.
Absolutely. Let's get the easy stuff out of the way. What's the temperature in Miami? Everyone wants to know that.
It's terrible. It's 82 degrees during the day, hot and humid already. And if we're lucky, we get 70 degrees at night. So you might love it. I hate it.
Well, those in the Northeast in our listening circle in may love those temperatures right now. So thanks for sharing that.
Well, come on down anytime. We expect all winter visitors.
You like the doors. That being said, we like to talk about healthcare and telehealth and give our listeners lots of information around healthcare and what they can use in their own daily lives as well, and understanding the healthcare world. What strategies do you believe are the most effective in optimizing some of the clinical workflows and simplifying technology adoption for any clinicians really within a metropolitan or large market health system like Baptist Health South Florida?
Thanks, Michelle. And to preface, so everyone kind of has an idea of what I did, right? I was at Baptist Health South Florida for just about 10 years, largest nonprofit health system in South Florida, in the Florida region, 11 hospitals, 30,000 employees. But back in 2016, 17, I was one of the first people to use our direct-to-consumer telehealth. I'm not a healthcare background person. I used to work in marathons, which obviously our friends in Massachusetts know well, and I used to work at the zoo. So I did some really re weird things. And when I got into healthcare, I'm like, hey, this telehealth thing, I went back to our executives and said, guys, this is a game changer. This is going to be something that our patients will love. The only other things they love about us are when we hand them their newborn babies. And when we tell them that they don't have something that they think they had. So this is a great way for a health system to really develop something that patients love. And I'm a huge proponent and advocate for the patient experience. Long story short, 2017, I got the keys to the kingdom and really grew the business of telehealth, but kept a very watchful eye on digital health. Thankfully, in 2020, we as a health system were prepared. We had all the things we needed to bring telehealth to life during COVID. And since then, a lot of advancement. So that's the background, real quick. And you asked me about,
Thank you.
yeah, no problem. Optimizing workflows, simplifying technology. The reason I said what I said is I'm neither clinical nor am I technologist. I am looking out for the consumer, and that consumer is the clinical team and the patient. So large health systems, especially those in metropolitan areas, where we're not looking at rural and community hospital coverage. One of the biggest challenges is having a unified approach. So a lot of times in digital, we talk about interoperability and we're talking about technology and we're talking about vendors. But the reality is having some sort of heterogeneity on how you operate has a huge impact on workflow optimization and bringing technology to life. Examples, if you're a multi-hospital system and they act as a federation of, states, bylaws. If your bylaws are different, it changes how you can apply telehealth in your setting. You have various nursing councils who might have different perspective. You have your medical executive committees who might have. So you got to go through all these motions from an adoption perspective, from a workflow perspective, and that cascades down to how each specialist operates, right? Whether they're in-house and employed or on-call coverage. So you got to find a way to unify as much of that as possible. It requires boldness. It requires being prescriptive, but it starts with listening and understanding the environment. So you can't just come in like a bull in a china shop. You have to understand and then show them what's right, what's possible, what's beneficial. I think that's the most important role of technologists in healthcare, when we aim to change processes.
That's such a good point of helping clinicians understand what's possible. It's not their job to be technology experts, right? And it's our job to understand what the technology can do to enable their business, and they can decide whether or not that brings the value that they anticipate and whether they want to potentially adopt that, assuming it's not a top-down decision. But it's important to be able to distill the information about the technology and what the offering is for a variety of different reasons, in my opinion. And you touched on a couple of them, but also it's real easy to get sucked into the shiny object in the sales and the marketing gimmicks that get brought to you. And we talk a little bit about some of the work we do in the vendor selection space, which kind of tries to homogenize vendors and really start to bring, some balance there. But it's important to understand first what it is that, you really want to, what do you really want to do and what do you want to accomplish here? But that's our jobs in
And
this.
laying some of that groundwork, Michelle, right? Like bylaws are the best example. It takes
Exactly.
a motion of Congress to, to change a bylaw, but those bylaws can be the number one obstacle or barrier between a really optimized telehealth approach and one that is just kerfuffled over months or years.
So help people understand how those bylaws briefly, because it's not part of our, normal conversation, but I think it's important that people understand how do those bylaws create those barriers?
Yeah, so I'll give you a simple in the acute care setting for telehealth as an example, right? The bylaws may be as descriptive or as defined to say that no non-physician is allowed to initiate a telehealth visit, right? So again, I'm giving you, this is probably not how they're written because typically these bylaws were written before telehealth even existed. But you find things like that, which means that a nurse practitioner cannot be a party to a telehealth visit. And so if the bylaws don't allow for that, right, depending on, and I'm not speaking about any particular health system, just
No.
generally, if the bylaws don't allow for that, well, guess what? You're severely constrained in your ability to optimize workflows and optimize use of staff. And obviously there's a lot of layers in that one little hypothetical I gave. And so, yeah, it takes an act of Congress to really make those changes, or it takes boldness to say, hey, we need to prepare for the future. We need to look at our bylaws and make sure we can change certain components to accommodate what's happening in the next 6 months, 12 months, 24 months.
It's such an innovative technology, is no question. It's a disruptor. It happens, and a good one is. I think people think that if they go to a particular health system, no matter where they are in that health system, that their doctor can potentially practice medicine in that health system. But it is the bylaws that might say no, they cannot. Again, that may prevent some telehealth. But you touched on this idea of, workflows and challenges, and what are the specific challenges around bridging the gap between technology and physician or consumer adoption, and particularly when you think about it in an acute care or a main hospital setting.
I think my background in consumer engagement, I think, gave me a leg up on technologists. So, and what I mean by that is, I think most technologists, most vendors, most tech companies, and even leaders in the healthcare space don't understand the psychology of change and adoption. Clinicians have a, hopefully everyone knows this, and I'm not letting a cat out of the bag. Clinicians have a negative history with technology. Whether that's mostly in part due to the era of EMRs and meaningful use, I'm not going to say the why, but the trust gap between technology and physicians, but I'll say clinicians, it's pretty large, or it's large, it's sizable enough. The skepticism is real. But it's also pragmatic from a physician perspective. Their lives have been made really dutiful because of technology. And they don't necessarily feel that technology actually understands their workflows and needs. So I think your question about challenges and bridging the gap, it's really about listening, understanding, even if you're feigning interest. You have to listen, you have to earn trust. And I think this is where, folks like Blue Cirrus are great as third parties. Change management has to be done thoughtfully. And understanding that, one, we're going to make change, and two, it cannot take forever, is a fine line to walk on the physician side. I can give you some guidance on the consumer side too, if you want to hear that.
Of course, please.
So I think what we saw, especially with direct to consumer, and even now with AI, and when I talk about AI in healthcare from a consumer perspective, I look at symptom checkers as kind of like, the litmus test. On the consumer side, their psyche is loaded with skepticism too. It's a little bit different. We've built an industry around personal relationships and face-to-face engagement. When in reality, with the advent of technology and data via AI, data via, a lot of other uses, those individual personal relationships really don't matter as much anymore. Now, don't get me wrong, the physician relationship matters, but the way it comes to life, we're starting to see a shift in this multi-generational audience of ours, where my mom wants to see one doctor, but I'll see any doctor that's part of a brand that I trust. And so that same mindset applies to technology, both the multi-generational perspective. We've had major privacy breaches as recently as, change. And so it takes time for adoption, and we have to prove, that we can make those changes in a way that bridges the gap, right? And I'll talk later, maybe later on, we can talk about AI and symptom checkers and how that plays a part, in taking steps towards adoption.
We're all getting the letter that says that we're getting free Equifax because of the Change Healthcare.
Really, that's not what I needed. I needed to be able to pick up my wife's prescription for $3, not $330 last Monday. That's what I needed, not Equifax. But
Yeah,
anyway.
exactly. That's another show completely.
Yeah, a good one.
And you're right. Some of the change management activities can be really the hard, and this is true of any industry, really. Change is hard, and no one wants change. And in healthcare, it's such a regulated industry that and a trust industry, and we've unfortunately had a degradation in trust in healthcare over the last few years, post-COVID, for whatever reason. Even pre-COVID, there was some concern about that. And there's some strategies that we have to employ in healthcare to help people understand, I think, how the industry works,
And
and that requires some transparency as well.
just one other comment on that, Michelle. Like the dichotomy of this, I would challenge everyone to think of this. Here we are as an industry who is increasingly serving, heavily serving our aging and sick populations, right, at an increasing rate, while also trying to plan our future 2 years, 5 years, 10 years from now for this larger population of millennials. So there's a dichotomy there. It's really hard to bring what a younger, healthy population wants in the future to a current sick population who doesn't value it the same. So there's a, that's a balance. And time is the best tool, but there's a balance.
That's a really good point. That's a really good point. And programs like Hospital at Home have been used for those folks that are sicker. Maybe they've just done a procedure. They can go home potentially, but they don't, they want to be able to discharge more quickly out of the hospital. This is a really innovative program. If folks haven't learned about this or experienced this, this is you may have done a procedure rather than staying in the hospital for 3 or 4 days because there may have been some complications. Maybe they can bring, some hospital tools to your home and actually have what's called Hospital at Home. And it's shown a lot of promise, but there's so many obstacles around it to prevent this widespread adoption. I think there's a lot of reasons for that. But what do you think about the challenges around that? How can we overcome that and get some success in this hospital at home space, barring major regulatory change?
I think vulnerability is a good personality trait. On my end, one of my hopes and goals and visions was always to grow remote patient monitoring and hospital at home. And I'll tell you, the value proposition is this. I believe technology, and I'll answer your question in a second. I think technology allows us to exchange low value for high value relationships. In a lot of meaningful ways. So as a health system, right, what you value out of a relationship might be different than what a patient values. But with hospital at home and remote patient monitoring, you really have the ability to synchronize low value, high value. What I mean by that is a insignificant follow-up visit post-surgery is a low value visit. For really it is, but it's a high value opportunity if a patient can be at home, right? And so how do you do that? So I think what I saw developing in hospital at home, across the country, really came down to your core business as a health system. Have you been able to get out of fee for service, or are you still predominantly fee for service? Have you made the shift to value-based care? Do you already have a home health program? Because it really depends on what your experience has been and what your tolerance is and what your infrastructure is. So, because the second part of that really is, how do you manage staffing and demand for those services? I won't get into billing and all that stuff. I think that's a whole other conversation. And I think there's a couple considerations. A health system that understands how to load balance clinical need, right? So let's just say you have 20 hospitals. Finding a way to centralize some of that care gives you the resources available to then invest in some of that remote care that you might want to do through hospital at home. But if you have to have individual sites staffed by the same number of people across 20 hospitals, load balancing is not being done well. So I think that's a critical, and that, by the way, that goes back to bylaws too. I think that's a critical decision for health systems to make. How do we load balance? How do we have centralized connected care models that gives you clinicians that can provide you hospital at home services, right? And also hospital at hospital services, right? So I think that's one part of it. Creating the right partnerships with vendors. So if you can't staff, if you can't hit the road, so to speak, for the stuff that requires a nurse on site or a clinical partner, do you have the right vendors who you trust? Do you have the right vendors who you can use to work on your behalf? And we're seeing obviously a lot of that. A lot of money went into, and I won't name companies here, but a lot of different companies in different markets that kind of serve that role of being that nurse in home without being tied to a health system. To me, if I'm a health system, I'd much rather have a partner who can do that for starters, measure, gauge, look at some KPIs, and then decide, do I invest in owning this and going in-house or not? Right? Or find another opportunity. There are a lot of joint ventures out there now, a lot of opportunities. So that's what I see as some of the challenges. Just to recap, are you fee for service or value-based care? And what's your makeup as a health system is probably the number one challenge. And then figuring out staffing, whether through load balancing or partners, would be the next challenge, obviously, aside from billing.
Absolutely great advice, especially in what I call bridging. That's what you described with, utilizing a partner to be able to bridge over and decide whether or not you want to continue to do this, or you want to expand it, or you want to do it differently. That allows you to have some flexibility and potentially even invest in your partner.
And given, I now work on a different side of this business, from an investment and private equity perspective, a lot of those third parties are backed by private equity, and they're just trying to show that they have a new client. So you actually have leverage as a health system sometimes to kind of get involved, because they're just trying to grow the number of clients, the volume, and all that. So it might be mutually beneficial sometimes to do a 1 year or 2 year kind of proof of concept.
Yep, you're absolutely right. You're absolutely right. So, in your experience, what are the factors that contribute to successful integration of technology into healthcare workflows? We saw this in the telehealth space. We have to integrate disparate technologies together. We need to be able to integrate it into the workflows, as you mentioned. But what are those key factors to be able to be successful in that?
Yeah, so I won't touch on like the 2019 word of the year, interoperability, but that's obviously important. We've seen health systems invest heavily in bringing technology in-house to try and solve some of those problems. I think we'll see in a couple of years whether that stays in-house or doesn't. I think push and pull is really important. The balance of push and pull tactics, finding the right pilot programs. pilot leaders, the right, I mentioned proof of concept earlier on hospital at home, right? POCs, as we call them. Finding the right POCs and the right champions, super critical, and really should be part of a change management mindset. How are you approaching change management? You know, you can take, everyone knows about the elephant. If you want to eat the elephant, you're only going to do it in chunks. And so chunking is a really important concept when you do some of this stuff, unless you happen to be a health system or organization that is super innovative, super progressive, and has all the right pieces already put into place. So I would never suggest starting anything system-wide. I think you have to be very strategic about how you start, knowing that whoever you start with, wherever you start, is someone who can help you scale and expand.
Great advice. Great advice. And then how do you, from your perspective and your experience, how do you propose addressing the technology adoption issues in a behavioral health setting or even in acute care and outpatient? Really, it's everywhere. And what strategies can be employed to encourage both the patients and the providers to embrace some of these technologies that we are seeing moving into the industry and even as far as AI?
You know, I think this goes back to kind of what I was talking about investment. I think in behavioral health in particular is where digital has just done it right. We have seen a significant amount of success and investment, particularly in direct-to-consumer behavioral health. So I think we're starting to see more patients, so to speak, more people, consumers, pursue behavioral health, even if some of it's tied to lifestyle and not your traditional acute care behavioral health issues, right? So I think that's huge from a stigma perspective. There's some really great stories out there of companies that have really changed the consumer experience around behavioral health. There's also some that make you question the goals of some of these companies, but that's a whole other story. But at the same time, I think we're seeing a population of specialists, especially in behavioral health, aging population, right? There is an influx of younger behavioral health specialists too, right? Who are open to being available via telehealth. And so I think it's really the winner in the telehealth game is behavioral health. And I've seen it where you have physicians who want to retire because they're rounding across multiple hospitals. And look, it's a tough job to begin with. It's made tougher when you have to bounce from this place to that place and really manage your schedule. So if we can see that acute care, right, psych, that acute care, you know, mental health support going through telehealth, which really is feasible for probably 98% of those patients, really, especially with an on-site provider, right? You can see more physicians sticking around, avoiding retirement, still serving the needs of the health system and the patients, which we know behavioral health is one of the greatest needs across this country. And the acute care setting, our physicians, you know, the benefit of having, you know, psych on call within even 12 hours, okay, like that's a win compared to an in-person on-call coverage. Now, if you can do it within 2 hours, that just, again, it goes back to low value, high value. That means we're solving patient needs immediately, creating space for more patients, and helping physicians move on to the next patient, right? So I think that's, I don't think there's technology adoption issues in behavioral health. I think we just need to move more people to digital and make it possible. Again, back to bylaws, back to workflows, back to optimization.
Yeah, I think it just lended itself so easily to being telehealth because it's there's talk therapy, but also medication management is not difficult to do over telehealth. Obviously, you want to be able to, like you, I'm not a clinician, but you want to be able to see that patient at some point, whatever that interval is from a clinically appropriate time scale. But where I see it running a little bit awry, well, I'll say this from a listener perspective, where does this matter to you? And this matters because it's likely if one if you or your family member or friends are into a in an emergency room with a behavioral health crisis scenario, it's very difficult to have someone see you, and it takes a long time. And having a knowing that there's a psychologist or a psychiatrist or whomever to be able to do an evaluation and be able to move you to that next level within a timely fashion is really important. Just like you would expect if you had a broken arm, you'd want to know that there's a surgeon there to help you. And reality is for behavioral health, there's not one sitting there 24/7. So
And just to paint that picture clearly for the listeners, and thanks for reminding me about the listeners, is if you are admitted on a Friday night with some sort of episode, and your hospital, whether you're rural or urban, it doesn't matter, and your hospital can't get you that psychiatric consult until Monday morning, think about the implications on you as a family member or you as a patient and the staff caring for you. So to be able to do that within 2 hours or even 12 hours, and I've seen both, that's the value opportunity, right? It's time as a value, not money as a value, and a
right.
lot of stress that can be reduced on many people.
Time is money in that case, for sure. And obviously, you're right, stress is reduced as well. Yeah, so it definitely lends itself to a great usage in the behavioral health space. There's still a lot of barriers to get past, including, some of those companies that you mentioned, maybe hiring folks away from the underserved areas because they can pay them more and their flexible schedules and all of those types of things, which is another show that we can talk about. But it is an important advancement. And I think one of the soapboxes that I get on is, what about the patients and the technology gap that we might be getting? So that's an area that folks really need to understand what services and resources are available to you to be able to get sometimes free and reduced technology, either a cell phone or a tablet, as well as data so that you can access your healthcare resources in the same way, and we can keep health equity at the top of mind.
And to that point, I would always tell everyone when it comes to health equity, first think of your libraries. There's so much that libraries can provide you. It's incredible. It's not just books. And I see that here in South Florida, you can get a hotspot, so you have access to internet. I mean, it's incredible.
And they're expanding. They want to be that source of information. So I agree. That's a great spot. So don't want to catch you off guard, but here's one last question. What do you think the next big thing is going to be?
I think it's so trendy to say AI, and I look at it as care, CAIR. It is inevitable. It is inevitable that we will see the role of AI change how we do anything, whether it's the ability to actually assess a biopsy in the OR by taking that sample and having a computer look at it and run models against millions and millions of other models. Or it's symptom checkers. Look, if I'm a listener and I'm thinking about my future encounter with healthcare, I would want to test every bit of technology that's out there as long as it doesn't make me sicker, make me lose time, or make me have pain. So go have fun with a symptom checker because I can tell you in 3 to 5 years, it's the only way we're going to solve for our primary care physician shortage is by letting technology do differential diagnosis. Listen to our patients. And then it becomes so critical to health systems to use that data and be more human than we ever could be before. Right? So technology will allow us to be more human. And I think as you hear artificial intelligence, think about it as improving healthcare so that healthcare can be more human. That's what I think is going to happen in the next 3 to 5 years.
Healthcare more human. I like that one. I'm going to steal that. I think that's great advice. And I don't think we should be afraid of artificial intelligence. We know that the AMA has already said it is not a replacement for physicians. And we know healthcare is considering that. It is not a replacement. We're not suddenly going to have robots that are going to be making diagnosis for us, but we are going to do exactly what you described. Let me get a quick biopsy review. I don't have to wait 4 days. I can get it while I'm there. I know exactly what that is, and I'm done. And think of the power that we can unleash for patients and for providers in that space.
Reduce so much stress and consternation. Absolutely.
Yep, absolutely. Great. It was great to have you on the show, Danny. This was a great interview. We got to come back and talk about AI again. We got to talk about all the topics that we parking lot for the show for other times. Thank you so much for being here. I appreciate your time today. And we always want to provide our listeners with helpful information about in this show about healthcare and telehealth. We really appreciate you coming on and sharing your experience.
A pleasure, and I always learn a lot from you. So, my pleasure to be here with you.
Thank you so much. I hope you have a great rest of the week. Thank you again for educating us in this space. This is WATD 95.9. We will be right back with another guest. And don't forget, Blue Sirius Radio, we are the smartest show on radio.